We have mentioned and talked about the Space Merchants, which is one of your more widely known stories. On one of your other widely known stories, what was the origin for Gateway and the Heechee?
Well, the first part of it, the first development of it, was what is called the Fermi Paradox.
Yeah.
If there are other living, intelligent life forms somewhere in the galaxy, why haven't they come to call on us?
Right.
So I thought one answer to that was that there is a time problem. Possibly the lifespan of an intelligent, civilized race is no more than 10 or 15,000 years, in which case they can come and go without ever being in the same time as another one.
We might have a galaxy that has millions, hundreds of millions of intelligences. They just never overlap in time.
Right.
And so contact with other alien societies is all done by archaeologists.
So I thought, okay, so maybe there was another intelligent species some time ago, and it did visit the Earth, but there wasn't anything here worth talking to except some hairy little bipeds that didn't even have a language, and they're gone. And then what happens if we find some of their artifacts? And I first wrote that in a story called The Merchants of Venus.
Uh-huh.
I described some tunnels on the planet Venus that were left by this ancient race, and they didn't leave much else. And I published that. It was kind of a nice story. I was glad to write it. And I thought, gee, that's not very adventurous. What if they found something like spaceships that these people had left, and you could get into them and fly around? So then I tried to write a novelette, sort of an adventure novelette about finding these spaceships and getting into them and having adventures. And it just didn't seem to go anywhere. And then I began thinking in terms of what it would be like to be in a spaceship that was going to go somewhere, but you had no choice about where it went and what would happen when you got there. And I tried writing it that way. And then at the same time, this was in roughly 1972, 3, 4, somewhere in there. At this time is when the encounter groups were heavily into American civilization, and there was a lot of psychoanalysis going on. And I thought, well, let's talk about a character who is needing some sort of therapy and see how he tells this story of these spacecraft and so on. And therefore, I developed the character of Robinette Broadhead. Then I decided to write the story in two voices, him going through his therapy and remembering all these things, and then the things that happened.
Yeah.
And then that wasn't quite satisfactory either. And I tried to find some way of giving the reader a fly-on-the-walls vision of what was going on, so he would actually know more than the character did. So I began writing these sidebars that go throughout the book.
Yeah.
So it was a case of gradual accretion of themes and ideas that made up the final book.
Yeah, and the little accreted stuff around the side. There was at least one printing of the book that left most of those out, or many of them out.
Oh, really?
As I recall. Well, and then a later one did include them, and I suspect someone thought that they were just like the art or something that went with it. They were some of the most wonderful bits in the story.
I thought they were kind of fun. There was a little problem, though.
When did you fold in the idea about not only are you getting in a spaceship and you have no control over where it's going, but it's even worse, you don't even know how long it's going to go? It's like this lottery, this cosmic lottery.
Hmm.
When did you pull that idea into the...
In the process of developing the story. I can't say just when any of it happened. There was a problem with the sidebars, which is when the people who do talking books for the blind were doing it, they called me up and said, hey, where did we put the sidebars? I said, I don't know.
That's your problem.
Right? I don't know what they did.
Yeah. Gateway ended up being this most incredibly... I mean, there's this line that Campbell said he wanted his stories to sound like, you know, they had actually been written 200 years in the future in a magazine from 200 years in the future and just kind of, you know, sent back in time.
Mm-hmm.
And Gateway, more than almost any other book I've seen, had that feel of being a real document from a real time.
Warren,
because
of
all the weirdness.
You can go on talking like that as long as you want to. I mean,
okay.
I'm enjoying it.
But no, there was an almost unpolished edge to all the pieces and the way they fit together and they interleaved, but you could feel the edges pushing into each other the way real life does.
That's a good description of what I was trying to do, yes.
Yeah, that was incredible. And you followed it up with several more books, and it's like...
Actually, I haven't broken the habit yet. The book I am almost finishing is still another story in that series.
Novel?
It's sort of a novel. It is a novel, but I'm going to have trouble with Charlie Brown because he's not going to call it a novel in Locus. It starts with a novella that I wrote for Bob Silverberg called The Boy Who Would Live Forever. And after I'd written it, I realized it had the beginning of a novel there. So I've written four or five other major segments and a lot of continuing tissue, linking tissue. And it's almost done. I've been editing it here. I have the first 10 parts of it completely done and the remaining four about half done. So
there's a new Heechee story.
Yes. Got some pretty good stuff in it, too.
Hot damn. When?
I haven't signed a contract yet, partly because, well, for complicated reasons, I haven't signed a contract yet. But I expect to sign it within the next 60 days or so. And then it will probably be out maybe next summer, something like that. Don't ask me which publisher, because that's why it's a confusion. I don't know which publisher yet.
I'm just thinking I have to wait that long for another Heechee story.
Actually, you don't, because some parts of it have been published.
Okay.
Silverberg has one part in his Far Horizons Amazing Stories, published another part of the two-part serial.
Uh-huh.
That was called Rejuvenating the Phoenix, or something like that. And there's another part. It's in the Daw 30-year thing.
Hmm.
It's called The Old Ones, which is a part of it.
So the pieces are around there.
Pieces are around.
Don't you hate it, though, when you take all those pieces and then write the connective tissue and do things to unite them, and then they call that a paste-up novel?
Yes,
I hate it.
Let's go beat up Charlie Brown.
Okay, you hold him and I'll whack him. Or I'll hold him and you whack him. Either way. Take turns. I mean, it's funny, you mentioned Ace, and I keep thinking about Ace and the Ace Doubles, and there were all these fun things that could have been done with the Ace Doubles that no one ever did. Like, take a story. And the one book would be the story told from one person's perspective. Flip the book over, and it's the same story, but from somebody else's perspective. I mean, there are these wonderfully weird things you could do.
Interesting idea.
I mean,
if I were still an editor, I might even think seriously about it. But I've given up all those childhood
things. And it still might be something to do now, is to do a flip-over novel.
I think it might be a really good idea.
Or it might also be a fun thing to have, you know, think about how to collaborate. Because there are all these ways to collaborate.
Yeah.
And one way to collaborate is one person writes the one, another person writes the other, and they just have to coordinate on making sure, you know, that they've got all the high points together.
Yeah.
There's fun stuff people could do. The Ace Double format seemed to open that. It just
somebody else tried to do it. It might have been Jim Bain tried doing doubles. But
yeah, he did.
They didn't seem to go over for reasons I don't know.
Yeah, part of it may have been, and this is a weird one, I mean, the Ace Doubles had two covers.
Yes.
And Tom Dougherty was saying that when he looked at what sells books, it was, you know, 25% word of mouth, 25% who the author is, and 25% the presentation, the package, the cover. Mm. And I'm thinking, well, if the cover sells, having two covers doubles your odds of selling. If you have two books and one cover.
Good thinking.
It's something like that. But, yeah, you're right, though.
There are cases when I know that the cover sells the books. So Jaws. I was at Bantam when Jaws came out, and the art director was a difficult person who invented the cover on Jaws, which has somebody swimming, and down below you see the shark.
Yeah.
You could not avoid wanting to read that book.
And certainly there are books where I have read the book in spite of the cover.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the publishers, including some of my own, have the habit of publishing generic covers, which is to say it's a spaceship somewhere or it's a towers of a futuristic city somewhere, and they all look alike. And I try to talk them out of that, but not always successfully.
Well, there's a cover on the Space Merchants that had, you know, kind of futuristic city in the background, but a very realistically drawn yellow pedicab.
Yeah, that was the original magazine cover.
That was just an incredibly wonderful cover. I really like that over a lot of the other covers I'd seen on that book.
Yeah, that was M. Schwillard in that. Unfortunately, he's not around and there aren't too many like him.
Yeah, he was good.
Yeah.
As an editor of magazine, how much interaction did you have with the artists that were doing your covers and stuff
at
like that?
At Galaxy and If, I had pretty nearly total connection. We did have an art director briefly, but I was there 10 years, and for 9 of those years, I was the art director. And, as you were discussing with Hal Clement, sometimes an artist would come in with a sketch. Well, frequently, artists would come in with sketches, and I would pick one and say, yes, I'll take that. Then I would have the problem of getting a story to fit it. Some editors don't care about that. They don't care if the cover relates to anything inside, but I felt it was cheating not to have a story.
Yeah.
So I'd get somebody like Hal Clement to write a story based on it.
Yeah.
And as Hal told you, sometimes I would have to do something to the cover because I didn't like it. I'd take one little corner of it, and that would be what was on the magazine. Another thing I had learned from John Campbell, by the way, he did that with the covers for some of the Doc Smith stories. There is one which shows the lead character in one of the Lensman stories, Kimball Kinnison, I guess it was. And that cover shows just the face of Kimball Kinnison. But in the painting, that is one tiny corner of a much larger canvas that John didn't like and left out.
You edited Galaxy and then there were Worlds of If. You were also editing that, weren't you?
Oh, yes. We had Galaxy, If, and briefly we had another magazine called...
Worlds of Tomorrow.
Worlds of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
We also had a fantasy magazine, but I didn't care to ever edit that, so I gave it to Lester Del Rey.
Okay. Worlds of If was... I mean, it was really interesting seeing the stories that would appear in the one magazine versus the other. I mean, I think Worlds of If carried a lot of Niven stuff in the 60s.
A lot. Well, both Galaxy and...
Yeah.
I published Niven's first story and a second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth stories, too. I finally said to him, Larry, look, send one to John Campbell. He ought to publish this stuff, too. But actually, I think he did, and John bounced it for reasons I don't understand. But I told him he should be published in some of the other magazines.
Yeah.
Not that I wanted him to stop writing for me, but I just wanted him to get spread around a little.
You know, in thinking about the cover sells, there is one issue of Worlds of If where it's like, I bought the magazine because of the cover, and I think it was one of your stories, and I'm trying to remember, because it was the story that involved the moon was being used as a penal colony for all these aliens, and they were just, you know, basically the scum of the universe was being dumped on the moon.
Yes.
And I think that
wasn't my story, and I can't remember whose it was. I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah, and I'm totally blanking on who wrote the story, but it was incredibly memorable.
It's so memorable we can't remember.
We can remember the story, we just can't remember the name, which is really what authors hate to hear.
Exactly.
But the cover of the magazine had, you know, a fairly realistic and naturalistic spaceship sitting on the moon and two astronauts outside it, and then this alien creature under a bubble-domed helmet holding up a gun with the crosshairs on the helmet of one of the astronauts. And I saw that, and it was just so... intriguing that I couldn't avoid buying the magazine and reading it. And then I read it ever since.
I think that was an M. Schuller cover, too.
It was. And now, what if I could figure out the name of the artist. Well, because it was the artist painting that dragged
into
it.
That's right.
And I guess I'm honor bound now, before we put this on the web, I will find the story and I will find the name of the author and put it up there so we will justifiably credit the person who wrote that story. It is amazing the way the covers sometimes influence us.
Yes. I tried when I was editing Galaxy to see just what it was about a cover that made people buy. So I went back over the records to see the sales of each individual issue, see which ones had peaked more than the others and which had been dogs in the market. And then I tried to copy what they had done. And I found out one thing for sure. The one thing I know that will not sell is something you've done before. But anyway, there is obviously a difference in covers as far as sales are concerned. But how to capitalize on that difference, I've never been able to find out.
Try to figure out what it is, even.
Yeah. So I finally reached the point of buying covers that I kind of like.
Yeah, and some of the covers, I mean, I generally like naturalistic covers that sort of illustrate something happening in the story.
Yeah.
Except what I find in terms of what do I like looking at, or what would I hang on a wall as just a piece of art if I had any space on the wall that wasn't filled with bookcases, is a lot of the more abstract stuff from the 1960s.
The power sort of stuff.
Yeah, all the weird abstract geometrical shapes and
they're
distorted
very
things. They're very interesting.
I don't know
pretty.
If they sold any books, though.
I don't know. But there was a period all through the 60s. Whereas, like, if it was a science fiction book, it was like an exercise in geometrical distortion.
That was Ballantyne's power steps that led the way. I sold a number of short story collections to Ballantyne at the time. And one of them had a story in it called The Celebrated No-Hit Inning, which was about the future of baseball. And Betty Ballantyne said, that's a wonderful idea. I'm going to have a cover based on that. So the book came out, and I had a copy of it, and Betty said, "How did you like your baseball cover?" And it was a Powers cover, and I hadn't realized that it was a baseball cover. One of these very abstract things.
Yeah. Oh, they look really pretty. They look really nice on the wall. It's just, yeah. I try to figure out, what are they illustrating?
Right. Can't tell. Powers was a wonderful artist, but yeah. I went to a show of his in New York on, 59th Street, where yeah. they have all the galleries. And he had a whole bunch of monochromes, New England fishing village yeah. stuff like that. Beautifully done. But he didn't do that sort of thing for his covers.
Oh, it has been wonderful hearing you talk about these things. And there's a wealth of stuff. We haven't even begun to talk. But we've been talking for it is amazing how time flies.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
It has been great fun talking with you, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
We will.
Real soon. But before you go, one last question. Since you have been in the field, you have worked both sides of the street.
All seven times.
And sometimes right down the middle.
Yes.
Editing, writing, fan, you name it. Have you ever painted a magazine cover?
Missed that. I'll have to try it sometime.
Okay. One side of the street you haven't walked. But in all the stuff that you've done, what is it that brings you the most joy?
Oh, writing. No question about it. Nobody loves an editor. I mean, it's sort of fun to be an editor because it's like having your own model train set to play with. You can make all sorts of things happen. But editors get forgotten very quickly. And writers, at least the books are still there. They're always still there with your name on them. They may be in a secondhand store. They may be in a dusty shelf in the library somewhere, but they're still there. And I get letters from people who have read books of mine, sometimes very touching. Yesterday, I was walking down a hall, or actually rolling down a hall on my little electric scooter, and a fellow stopped me and said, "Your book, Gateway, changed my life. Thank you." And he went away. So I didn't find out in what ways it had changed his life. But I've had quite a lot of letters which said something like that. Something I've written has meant something to mm-hmm. somebody. And that's very rewarding. Editors don't get that kind of fun.
Well, and you deserve it, because your writing and all the other things you've done in the field has just been phenomenal. And it has been something that changes people's lives. It shows us a different way to look at the world. Shows us an alternate way of seeing things that we might not have thought about. And it has always been great fun. Thanks for doing it. And thanks for taking time to share it with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This interview is copyright 2003 by Hour 25 Productions. All rights reserved. No other rebroadcast, transcription, or other use may be made without prior written permission.